Some Baltimoreans his age grew up idolizing Brooks and Frank Robinson, Burt Jones, Cal Ripken, and other sports legends. Steve Gimbel might have been a baseball and football fan, but he grew up in Baltimore a self-described Jewish science nerd who became fascinated with physics and an idol of Albert Einstein. He went on to study philosophers and scientists at UMBC and at Johns Hopkins. Today, he's chairman of the philosophy department at Gettysburg College. And he's written two books about Albert Einstein, with a deep look at the great scientist's years in Germany and the United States, and his influence on intellectual communities around the world. Steve Gimbel is our guest in the hour ahead, The Life, Science, and Philosophies of Einstein, after the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. The famous physicist Albert Einstein died April 18, 1955, in Princeton, New Jersey. The 60th anniversary of his death prompted some stories in the popular press about Einstein and his brain. His brain was removed within 7.5 hours of his death by the pathologist who conducted the autopsy. The brain that worked out the theory of relativity and made the development of nuclear fission possible has attracted attention because of Einstein's reputation as one of the foremost geniuses of the 20th century. But I never knew this story about what happened to Einstein's brain after his death. We actually might hear a little bit about that during this hour of the show. Neuroanatomy was not exactly the type of fascination our guest in this hour of midday had for Einstein. His interest was the living Einstein, his life, his science, politics, his philosophies, his sense of humor. Stephen Gimbel grew up in Baltimore and became fascinated with physics and an idol of Albert Einstein. He went on to study philosophers and scientists at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and the Johns Hopkins University. Today, Steve Gimbel is chairman of the philosophy department at Gettysburg College, and he's written two books now about Albert Einstein, with a deep look at the great scientist's years in Germany and the United States, and his influence on the intellectual communities around the world. The latest book is Einstein, His Space and Times. This is part of the Yale University Press's Jewish Lives series. And an earlier book just published a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, Einstein's Jewish Science, Physics at the Intersection of Politics and Religion. Johns Hopkins University Press was the publisher of that. Stephen Gimbel is the Edwin T. and Cynthia Scherer Johnson Professor for Distinguished Teaching in the Humanities and Chair of the Department of Philosophy, as I said, at Gettysburg College. And he grew up here in Baltimore. It's great to have you on the show, Steve.
It's wonderful to be here.
Einstein's brain. I mean, I know that people have been fascinated with this over the years. It's been speculated that it was bigger, that he had more cells than others did.
More
and all
connections
that.
In certain parts
more
of the brain.
More connections, right. That actually grew as he got older. I've heard all kinds of stories. But, you know, I saw a headline the other day when I Googled Albert Einstein, because I was looking for this splendid review of your book in the New York Review of Books, and it said, Einstein's brain stolen, you know, exclamation point. I thought, was that new? That's not, no, actually, this goes back to the autopsy. So
exactly. After he died, the coroner thought, well, this is Albert Einstein. I can't simply dispose of the whole body, that wonderful brain. So unauthorized, he simply removed it and kept it. And it was a novelty for years. It ended up getting passed around to various people. And then after a while, parts of it started disappearing and being spread throughout the country.
It got passed around to people who wanted to research it, who thought this could be something big or no?
It was simply an artifact, a curiosity.
Have it over for dinner?
Exactly.
Oh, my goodness. Speaking of dinner, I guess there must be nobody, no one in life that you'd rather have dinner with than Albert Einstein.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Einstein was just such the character. He was not only a genius, but you know, one of the reasons everybody just adores him is there was just that personality. So, you know, he would be just a fascinating character.
And quite a sense of humor, as you discovered.
Oh, he did. The way it was often described was that he would laugh like a barking seal.
Well, you grew up in Baltimore, as I said. You went to Pikesville High School and then Boys Latin.
I did. Graduated from Boys Latin. Played lacrosse there for Coach Bobby Shriver. Just got his 500th
victory. I know.
Congratulations,
boy,
Coach.
He has been around for a while, hasn't he? So you graduated in the 80s.
86.
So I said, you know, you were probably your sports heroes at the time. Let's see, in the 80s, Who would that have been?
Oh, I guess Eddie was
Eddie,
name.
Eddie Murray. I didn't mention him, but Cal was a few years into his career, and Burt Jones in the 70s was a quarterback for
Absolutely.
The Colts. But Albert Einstein. So when did Albert Einstein come into your life?
Well, you grow up a Jewish nerd. You can't help but love Einstein. I grew up, my dad and I would watch, Novo on PBS, and I just fell in love with the big questions in science. And so there was just little doubt in my mind that science would be what I would study. I went to UMBC, ended up majoring in both physics and philosophy. Physics as a subject has always been something I've been passionate about. And then I discovered philosophy as just a wonderful method, a way of thinking of things. And I had a wonderful teacher there who introduced me to philosophy of science, then philosophy of physics, and was fortunate enough to come here to Hopkins to do my work in philosophy of physics.
And we throw some history of science in there, too, as well, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I studied under two wonderful professors here at Hopkins, Peter Achenstein and Rob Reinishevitz, both of whom take a very historical approach to questions of the history and foundations of the physical theories. And, it seems trivial to say that, science is done by scientists. Of course it is. But when you think about the way we really think about science, it's almost as if it's this objective, externalized thing that comes to us from the heavens. I mm-hmm. guess in astronomy it does. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that it's this thing that simply is its own being. Whereas really it's done by people who have backgrounds, who have proclivities, who were in certain places at certain times. So when we ask, why did this scientific theory arise when it did? Part of the answer has to do with the science, but part of it has to do with the figures, the people. And we need to rehumanize science. I think that's one of the things we don't do well in teaching science.
Well, timing is everything in comedy, love, and something else. But also, I guess, when it comes to the development of this theory of Einstein's, right? Was he sort of in the right place at the right time? He was the right man for his times in terms of that?
I think there's no doubt there. I mean, on the one hand, there was this period, the generation before World War I, where everything was in flux. Politics, art, science, mathematics, philosophy, everything was being turned on its head. And here Einstein stood at this period where everything was in flux. And at the time, it seemed like physics was done. At the end of the 19th century, physicists were kind of cocky. They thought, okay, we have one or two little problems. We'll figure those out. And then there was actually the thought that physics would be finished. We could write the book, and then all you had to do was study it, that there would be no more live questions. But Einstein, he was of a different sort. So when he went to university, he had a very conservative physics professor as the head of the ETH, the university where he went in Zurich. And they were to learn only the classics. But he thought physics is what physicists are doing. And he loved the little puzzles, the problems, the new stuff that was coming out. And so he ran afoul of the authorities there, something he did throughout his life. But he realized there were some serious problems that everyone else was trying to sweep under the rug. Turns out when he thought of them, it revolutionized the whole field.
What did he focus on? Time, space, probabilities, what?
Yes.
All of that.
What he had in his head was a sort of worldview, an entire picture of how the universe worked that ran counter to the way that physicists at the time were thinking. So it was Einstein. He had this magnificent year in 1905, right? He's not even a working scientist at this point, right? He had been frozen out of science completely. He was just an impudent student who wouldn't show his professors the proper respect. And so when he graduated and tried to find a job as an assistant under a physicist, couldn't find a job anywhere. A friend of his has a father who connects him to the patent office, so he's got a day job. But in the evenings, he's working on this worldview where he changes our picture. He's the one who nails down that atoms exist. He completely changes our picture of light and then space, time, and motion. All of this in five amazing papers in one year, 1905. And with that year, the last of those those five papers, the last two, were the theory of relativity. And that's the one that really made his name.
What was the reaction to all that, given what you said about the classic physicists?
The reaction was, That was it. Silence.
Really?
Nothing.
They didn't know what to say.
Einstein was sure that given how revolutionary this theory was, completely overthrowing every part of physics, that he would be given a professorship somewhere and treated as a hero. And eventually he was, but not in 1905. Because he was, after all, nobody. He wasn't even a working scientist. He wasn't at a university. He was some patent clerk who publishes these papers, and they were largely ignored. But there were a couple of people who paid attention, and one of them was a man named Max Planck, who was the most powerful physicist at the time.
In Germany, right?
Exactly. Right. And Planck was taking his work very serious. And so the idea was, well, wait a minute. If Planck is taking this seriously, maybe there's something to it. And so all of a sudden, you started to get a little bit of buzz. And then Planck basically mentored him, brought him into the scientific community. He started to, you know, work his way in as first a junior professor. And then he went to Prague as a full professor. And then off he went to become the Einstein that we know and love.
So what fascinates you about all of that? That he could develop those, what did you say, five major papers, five major studies, papers and theories, in a short period of time out of, I don't want to say out of nowhere, because he did attend university, but he certainly hadn't been at this a very long time.
He did seem to come from nowhere, right? In the sense that, you know, he wasn't a professor who had access to university libraries, who had access to laboratories. He was on his own. He was working as a patent clerk. And what he would do is he would work really hard, really fast to get a full day's worth of work done in half a day. Then in the afternoon, after lunch, he could work on his physics. And if, you know, one of his supervisors came down, they'd look at what he was doing, which was scribbling lots of, you know, equations,
right,
and graphs,
right,
and they'd
right.
figure, okay, this is what a patent clerk does. So he really was this fascinating character, but really it was the whole Einstein. Now, we have Einstein the genius, you know, as sort of the caricature, the cartoon. But he was really so much more than that. He was a person of his times. He was very politically active. He had fascinating thoughts about religion, about economics. And he was somebody who you couldn't but admire for his relationship to the world as a whole.
How did he feel about his religion?
Oh, that was actually very complicated. Mm-hmm. So Einstein had a personality. He was the sort who despised authority. If you had power, his thumb was going for your eye. And so as a young man, that meant both political power, but also religion. So when he's young, and this is actually up until about his 30s, he's very much what we would now think of as a militant atheist. It almost, in fact, cost him his first big job. He got this full professorship in Prague, and in filling out the application, there was a line for religion, and he put dissenter. He refused.
Dissenter, he wrote dissenter.
Exactly. He, you know, he was raised in a very secular
Jewish
home. Had a sense
of humor, too, didn't he?
Oh, he did, and he was sharp. He was raised in a secular Jewish home, and for a short period of time became very religious, I think in part in response to the authority of his father. But eventually that wore off, and he became just very much opposed to the sort of structure of organized religion, including his own Judaism. And so he becomes just an atheist, thinking about the world in this way.
It makes sense for a scientist, doesn't it?
Absolutely. But then
can't have God in the laboratory.
Well, most people can't, and Einstein mm-hmm. thought he certainly wasn't there, mm-hmm. that the world was made up of these bits that bounced around in very well-behaved ways. But then between the world wars, there was just a stunning rise in anti-Semitism in Germany. He swore he'd never go back, but eventually he did make his way back.
You mean he left Germany and came back?
He left Germany as a young man. He left when he was 16. His father and his uncle had an electronics company, which went bankrupt. Now, they were sure that electronics was just the business to be in. But Germany, with companies like Siemens, they thought, okay, the problem is the location. So they pulled up roots and they moved the family and the factory to Italy. Now, Einstein was a junior in high school at this point. And so his family said, stay here, finish high school, go to university, become an engineer, have a nice life. Well, Einstein hated the German schools, the rigor, the rote memorization. He just could not stand the structure. He thought it was just suffocating the humanity out of all of the students. And so here he was. His family's gone. All he's left with is a school that he hates. Now, what would anyone do? Well, normal Jewish boys would just turn passive aggressive. That's what we do. But not Einstein. Einstein figures out a way to get a doctor to write him a note excusing him from the rest of high school. Albert is suffering from a nervous condition. He has to leave. And so he hitchhikes from Germany to his family in Italy, shows up, and hands in his passport. He's not going to be German. At one point, he has to actually take an additional step to formally make himself a man without a country, in part because there was mandatory military service. And he wasn't going to do that. So he becomes a man without a country, absolutely sure he is never going back to Germany. Well, eventually, Planck comes to him with an offer he can't refuse. It's a professorship where he doesn't have to teach. He doesn't have to do anything except be Albert Einstein for a good bit of money. And this was the point where he was trying to formulate his general theory of relativity, the most difficult theory he worked on.
And Steve, that was where and what year did he return to Germany?
1913.
1913, and where?
He left Zurich, which is where he went to college, where he met his wife. He and his wife always had, his first wife had a very stormy marriage, but Zurich was where she wanted to be. Germany was his home turf. She did not want to go back, and this position was just too tempting for him. So when he accepted it, it really was the end of his marriage.
And in Germany?
Yeah, right.
So what university was it?
It was the University of Berlin.
At Berlin, okay.
Right.
But, all right. We're going to, I'm only asking that because a point in time, because after, we have to take a break and we'll pick up the story there of Albert Einstein. Freeman Dyson, the famous British physicist and mathematician, reviewed Steve Gimbel's latest book on Einstein, Einstein, His Space and Times. The time is now ripe for a short book summarizing briefly the well-known facts about Einstein's rocky road as a husband and father and scientist, and emphasizing his lasting importance as a politician and a philosopher. This book is accurate and well-balanced. It presents Einstein's Jewish heritage as he saw it himself, not as the core of his being, but as a historical accident bringing inescapable responsibilities. More on that with Steve Gimbel when we get back. You're listening to Midday. Welcome back to Midday. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. If you'd like to join our conversation, have a question about Albert Einstein for Steve Gimbel. Stephen Gimbel, who's a chair of the philosophy department at Gettysburg College, now with his second book on Einstein. And I was just quoting a very nice review in the New York Review of Books by Freeman Dyson, who pretty famous himself, British mathematician and physicist. Saying very nice things about your book and noting that it's short. We don't need, he says, we don't need another tome on Einstein. This is part of the Yale University Press's Jewish Lives series, Einstein, His Space and Times. So 1913, we'll pick up there. He goes back to Berlin. He goes back to Germany, and he has this, what sounds like a great gig in Berlin, but World War I is coming.
Yes.
And Einstein is not a fan of militarism, is he?
No, he's a pacifist, and, well, one
just
could say
opposite.
A militant pacifist,
yeah,
yes. Yeah. But he grew up in, you know, a very young Germany when he was born. Germany had only been a country for less than a decade, and so there was this, you know, hyper-patriotic, very militaristic feeling. And he, as a young boy, you know, really grew deeply distasteful for it. And there, before World War I, under the Kaiser, he saw the same sort of thing happening. And he was worried about it and spoke out at a time where it wasn't popular to not be pro-militaristic, pro-patriotic.
Were other scientists, did they of the same mind, or did they support the military effort?
It was almost universally in favor of World War I. See, Germany, you know, saw all of history as leading up to this moment. This was the moment where Germany would establish its greatness, its dominance over all of Europe and the world. And so World War I, when it first started, was, you know, universally assented to. And here was Einstein, this lone figure, you know, one of a very small group, objecting. And it made him deeply unpopular. Now, when the war ended and atrocities came to light and the war ended not so well for Germany, there was a deep split in the culture. And Einstein, you know, here he was, you know, seen as a traitor because he wasn't there to support the troops. There was really in Germany at the time this sort of cultural narrative from the right that the reason Germany lost the war, if they lost the war, right, and no one had invaded Germany, right, when you lose a war, somebody comes in and overthrows you. No one had invaded the fatherland. So the German conservatives didn't even think they lost the war. But if we lost the war, it was because those on the left had been insufficiently supportive. Mm-hmm. And here was Einstein, who was not only not supportive, he was opposing it. And then what happens? Well, at the end of World War I is when his theory of general relativity is confirmed by Eddington, who's observing an eclipse, and all of a sudden, headlines around the world, this strange new theory, and you have this wacky, bizarre physicist with the strange hair, and he becomes an international celebrity. A celebrity at the same time that the German economy is collapsing. Now, Einstein, like everyone else, needs money. Right? He's getting divorced. He has to pay child support. He needs money. You're a celebrity. What do? You go on a book tour like this, right? The idea is you make money off of it.
Did he go on a tour?
He did.
With E equals MC2?
Exactly. Well, more MC with squared. QE2, because he had to take
E equals boat. MC squared. Sorry.
But where does he go? Yeah. Well, he goes where the money is. Mm-hmm. He goes to England, he goes to France, he goes to the United States. And so the Germans see Einstein on boats under the flag of the enemy, you know, being celebrated by those who defeated Germany. And so not only was
he's Jewish.
Exactly. So not only is he seen as a traitor, but this is only reinforcing this image. And so he became a very deeply hated man by the German conservatives, by the German nationalists. And it was something he stoked.
Did he come and go from Germany during that time as we approach, we move on a couple of decades toward the beginning of World War II, into the 20s and into the 30s? Did he still live in Germany or did he actually, when did he move to the United States, I guess is my question.
Well, he lived in Germany for quite a while. He eventually entered into an agreement with Caltech, where he would winter in Los Angeles and then return to Germany for the nice parts of the year. And so since he was in Germany for 9 months a year, you know, they were always accusing him of being a traitor, of leaving. And he says, no, I'm here. I'm only there for the winter because, well, it's Southern California. But then Hitler came to power. And at that point, he was overseas. And it became very clear that he could not return. See, when he was there, he had been a big supporter of the Weimar government. And they had the first Jewish foreign minister, a man named Walter Rathenau, who was quite the figure. He was the head of the German General Electric. He was one of the most powerful men in the world. And there was this sense of, you know, sort of the Jewish control, the Jewish power focused in the owners of these large corporations. And he sort of embodied it. And when he was assassinated, there were very clear messages sent to Einstein that he was next on the list. And there were death threats, constant death threats, to the point where he and his second wife had to engage in, you know, false rumors that he had left the country when really he was just laying low. He had to resign, you know, posts from prominent organizations. You know, they were worried that around any corner could be someone with a gun.
So by the 1930s, when in the 1930s is he fully implanted here?
It's when Hitler comes to power in 33 that he simply says, I cannot return to Germany with Einstein in power. And the Germans said, good riddance.
Steve Gimbel is our guest. His two books about Einstein, the one I mentioned earlier, Einstein, His Space and Times, is most recently published by Yale University Press. And the one from 3 years ago, 2012, published by Johns Hopkins, is Einstein's Jewish Science. The phrase Jewish science I'm familiar with because I believe that's the dismissive term used by Hitler and the Nazi regime to dismiss Einstein and other German Jews who contributed to the understanding of the world.
Exactly. You had two things happening here. On the one hand, you had a real culture war where you had, you know, these new waves in music, in art, in architecture, in science, and they opposed the foundational ways, what, you know, the conservatives saw as the heart of authentic Germanness. And so here's Einstein, you know, a part of this, and leading the charge in all of these fields tended to be Jews. So he was lumped in there. But also, he was politically a very powerful figure. When Einstein said something, people listened. He joked at one point that he had a version of the Midas touch. Everything he said turned to newsprint. And so here he was as a political figure.
A celebrity. International celebrity. Yeah.
Being taken seriously. And his power needed to be curtailed, they thought. Well, what was the source of his power? It was this theory, this weird, bizarre theory. If we could undermine the science, we could undermine his political power. And so the idea was that this was not real science, authentic science, Aryan science. This was Jewish science, right? And the stereotype of the Jew is that, right, in the marketplace, they'll talk to you in a way that will leave you baffled. You'll think you left with a deal, and then you realize, ah, they got me again. And now they said, here was Einstein doing the same thing in science. Things that should start with observation, should start with the world. Now it's these strange, bizarre concepts. And so you had scientists, and they weren't just random nut jobs.
A question about that, though. Didn't the Nazi regime understand that Einstein's, quote, Jewish science had an application, that it could lead to nuclear fission?
Well, that came a little later, once we have quantum mechanics on board.
Okay, so when, in the timeline there, where is that then?
Well, that's closer to during World War II. Mm-hmm. So
later in the 40s. Then.
Later in the 40s. Okay. In the 30s, there was
There's no inkling of that in the 30s for the... No. Okay.
In the 30s, you have Einstein still, you know, within the scientific community. Mm-hmm. So at first, relativity is understood only by this small group. Eventually, with the end of World War I, it comes out into the larger public. But there's still this sense that it's Einstein, it must be tainted.
Okay.
We have to defeat it.
Right. And so why did you want to explore this question about Jewish science? Because you're not, this isn't a book where you just sort of examine the Nazi ridicule of Jewish scientists. You actually explore this question about whether there's anything to it, basically, right? Whether there's anything to this idea of a Jewish science.
Absolutely. Jews love Einstein. Well, everybody loves Einstein, but Jews, we really love Einstein, right? I mean, if you talk to Jews for any length of time, right, you're always going to hear the phrase, you know, he's Jewish, mm-hmm. right? It's like, you know, Jewish Jeopardy, you know, when a name comes up. But there's one person you never, ever have to say, you know, he's Jewish, and that's right. Einstein. And so the question was, why is Einstein, this man who, for much of his life, in a certain sense, rejected his Judaism, why is he held up as super Jew? Why is it that Einstein is this figure? Why do we love Einstein so much? And so the question was, is there anything we can say about the theory that in any way connects to some sort of Jewish foundation, some sort of Jewish way of thinking, some sort of historical track? And in most cases, the answer is no, right? So if you look at the science, right, there's nothing inherently Talmudic about it. But is there any way that Jews can say, you know what, in the way he thinks, he's one of us? And there is, I think, in some small way, you know, that what Einstein is really doing is bringing us scientific theories where he says the perspective we take on the world only gives us part of the story, and that what we always need to do is pair different perspectives together for a higher sense of truth. And if you look at the rabbis, that is something they also argue. So the claim here is not cause and effect. It's not that Einstein's the one who thought of it because he's Jewish. It's not that there are Jewish traces. You know, he had a slight bit of training when he was younger, but we know from letters he wrote that he really didn't pay much attention. So the question is this metaphorical one. Is there any way in which we can say this is a Jewish type theory? And I think in a small way, we can, which hopefully...
Well, I found I've only read the foreword on this book because I've had my hands full with Einstein, even though it's a short book, Einstein, His Space and Time. But I was fascinated by your foreword in this, and I wonder, when this book came out, because I missed this 3 years ago, was there backlash to your examination of that?
We thought there might have been, but it turns out there really wasn't.
The review I read was quite positive.
Yeah, the fear is that, you know, there's this oversimplified view in which everything is based in sociology and that background accounts for everything. And I'm very careful in the book to distance myself from that oversimplification and look at ways in which, you know, there's promise that it could be, but it turns out not to be what we could in some sense call Jewish science. But the hope was to take this term that came from, you know, this hateful place and rehabilitate it.
When the world made a fuss about Einstein, when his, you know, his sort of theories were confirmed and made his big splash, what went on in the world among, you know, average people in different capitals of the world in terms of responding to that, thinking, well, you know, I guess I better figure out what this is all about because everyone's excited about it, but I'm not sure I understand the relativity. What does that mean? Well, can you give me a sense of that, how the world reacted, just average people reading newspapers and listening to the radio?
The world reacted with a sort of collective scratch of the head, right? What it did, and it's fascinating that this really is the point where science gets beyond the public account of it. So before that, science really was something that, by and large, we could understand. But with Einstein, it really becomes so technical that it almost seems magical. And here's Einstein, who seems like this high priest. And I think part of what makes Einstein Einstein is that after World War I, the world is just weary. You know, we thought we were this unbelievably cultured civilization, and it turned out we were barbarians, right? The use of chemical weapons, trench warfare, it was just horrible. And here is this strange little man who doesn't wear a belt or socks, who has the strange hair, who says this unbelievably weird thing, which turns out to be right. And it sort of captured the imagination. And so Einstein becomes a celebrity, in part because of the theory, but in part because he was Einstein. He was always clever. He was always quick with a quip. And he was just an attractive figure, especially at a time when, you know, we had this division, and here was a chance to sort of heal wounds. He was German, but he was the new German, the rehabilitated German, the good German. And so there was this hopefulness with Einstein that the world could be a better, more interesting, magical place.
And people appreciated science or felt, gee, we better appreciate science because of what's going on with Einstein and others. There's such a buzz of, about them. There's a greater understanding of how the world works now because of them. So more appreciation of science than maybe we see in the year 2015?
Perhaps. Yeah, I mean, it's
I'm thinking
one
of the
those things.
So there's a sort of anti-science movement now.
Absolutely.
So this was a pro-science movement, wouldn't you say?
Well, you had, I think,
was it
this,
would you call it a movement, I guess?
I think you had the same split in that you had science represented not only a new way of seeing the world, but it was politicized, right? Scientists saw that it's in science that the French, the Germans, the British, the Americans can get together, speak the same language, and make progress together. And there was this sense of, you know, universal project that bound them together as opposed to the sort of nationalist project. And so there really was a polarization along political lines being pro and anti-science in the way that I think you do see it now, that global warming is this liberal plot, it's liberal science. I think what you see now is reflective of what you saw then. And so Einstein was seen amongst the nationalists in the way that, say, Jane Fonda was seen during the Vietnam War.
Hmm. I will take another break here and come back and talk some more about Albert Einstein with Stephen Gimbel, chair of the philosophy department at Gettysburg College, author of Einstein's Jewish Science, Physics at the Intersection of Politics and Religion, and now from Yale University Press, part of its Jewish Lives series, Einstein, His Space and Times. If you have a question for Steve while he's with us in the studio, please give us a ring, 410-662-8780. The toll-free long-distance number, good from Princeton, New Jersey, is 866-661-9309. And our email address, you can write a question, submit a question that way, midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Steve Gimbel, enjoying this hour of conversation about Albert Einstein, who died 60 years ago this month in Princeton, New Jersey. By the way, he ended up at Princeton when, Steve? Pretty much in the 1930s? Was he settled there by then?
He was. They opened the Institute for Advanced Study, and that was funded by Louis Bamberger, who had a guy named Abraham Flexner sort of setting up the whole thing. And Flexner went and met with Einstein when they were trying to figure out what it would be. Would it be associated with the university? Would it be its own thing? And in consultation with Einstein, they decided that it would be a center for theoretical science, where there wouldn't be laboratories. They would just, it would basically be Club Med for scientists, only in New Jersey.
Chalkboards and lots of chalk, right?
Where scientists would go, nothing would be expected of them, and they could just work.
By then, had he reached the end of his theorizing about relativity? Would you say, was there an end point to that?
Oh, not at all.
Okay.
For him, what he wanted, you know, the initial driver of his science was this unified worldview. And that's what he was working on till the day he died, was trying to take relativity theory and the rest of physics and unite it into one grand unified theory.
Once World War II broke out, the United States was involved in that, of course, and we get to the Manhattan Project, Robert Oppenheimer.
Right.
Where is Einstein in all that? What's he thinking about? What is he saying then about the opportunities to develop an atomic bomb?
Well, people, especially physicists, didn't think it could be done. So the idea that, right, we have E equals MC squared, that is, mass is just a form of energy. But C is a big number. C squared is a really big number. So a tiny bit of mass converted into energy would be a monstrous amount of energy, but no one thought it could be done. And then it was done. The atom was split, but people thought this is just too complicated. There's no way this could be harnessed. And then a friend of Einstein's, a man named Leo Szilard, who had fled the war, he was Hungarian, he was sitting at a traffic light in England, sitting in traffic in London, and all of a sudden it hits him. How it could be done. It would involve uranium, and if you had it in just the right way, you could get a chain reaction, and he realized that it could be weaponized. So he was leaving very soon for the U.S. He was going to be at Princeton. He was at Princeton. We knew this had to be stopped because the worry was that if this could be harnessed, this could be something serious. And there was a sense that the Germans were starting. Now, the man in charge of this in Germany was Werner Heisenberg of the uncertainty principle fame. And they knew he was very smart. He was a friend of Einstein's. And the worry was that given the situation, he might not be able to avoid. So they go to Einstein. They try to find him in Princeton. He's not there. It turns out he's on vacation. They eventually find him. He took another physicist friend, Eugene Wigner, because he had a car. They drove out to Long Island, show up on his doorstep. He greets them, has no idea why they're there. Szilard explains it, and he says, oh, my goodness, something needs to be done. So they decide.
Because they know Heisenberg is working for the Nazis. Yeah.
And at this point, you know, when you're looking for uranium, it's not easy to find. The big uranium mines were in the Congo. I mean, think back to, you know, Yellow Cake and the last war. Mm-hmm. And this was a Belgian colony. And the idea was, let's get in touch with the royal family in Belgium to make sure they don't sell uranium to the Germans. Well, Einstein, before he came to California, he originally was in Belgium for a while and was close friends with the royal family. And so the idea was Einstein could get a letter out. But the world now was at war. The idea of foreign nationals sending a cable to foreign leaders looked a little strange. Maybe they thought we should go through the U.S. government, through the State Department. Well, they couldn't figure out who to find. Eventually, they realized that Alexander Sachs, who would be the founder of Goldman Sachs, was very close to FDR. They would go through him. And so Wigner said, we'll come back, but it turns out he had to leave. So Szilard came back with another colleague, Edward Teller. And the famous letter to Roosevelt was written. The Manhattan Project was started, but Einstein was excluded because of his politics.
Okay, that's what I wanted to ask you about. Einstein was not going to be dragged into that, nor invited.
Nor invited.
Right.
You know, the FBI was keeping a file on him. He was seen as a security risk. He was a socialist, a leftist. He was not the person we wanted.
Let's take some calls, some questions from our listeners for Steve Gimbel about Albert Einstein. Let's go to John in Baltimore City. John, welcome to Midday. Go right ahead with your question.
Hi, my question was, ask Steve if he knows anything about Helen Dukas.
Helen Dukas. Who was Helen Dukas, Steve?
Helen Dukas was Einstein's personal secretary. When he lived in Princeton, eventually his wife and then his sister passed away. And Helen Dukas really was the person who took care of him. She was, you know, his confidant, his caretaker.
Was he absent-minded?
Yes, he was.
That's all true, then.
One of the great stories is that he was walking home from Princeton, and his secretary gets a call asking for Professor Einstein's home address. She says, "I'm sorry, I'm not at liberty to give that out." He said, This is Professor Einstein. I've forgotten where I live.
That's a good one, Steve. All right, Frank in Baltimore, a question for Steve Gimbel. Welcome to the show.
You practically answered my question. I was going to ask about the FBI surveillance of Einstein because of his views about, especially about American racism and civil rights. He cared very much. He was very moved by the lynchings and so on. Was he followed because of that specifically?
In part, yes. It was certainly his political views. Edward Teller, who was part of the writing of the letter, went on to become the father of the hydrogen bomb. He appeared on a program with Eleanor Roosevelt, where he argued for nuclear proliferation, or non-proliferation, that we needed to stop this madness. And the government took notice. J. Edgar Hoover had a deep dislike of Einstein and was actively trying to get him deported. So he was seen as part of the leftist conspiracy that, you know, this was a very dark time in American history. And he was seen as an enemy of America. But because he was Einstein, in a certain sense, he was largely untouchable.
William in Sparks, with your question for Steve.
I'm curious. In some circles, is Einstein a bit regarded as infamous as the father of the atomic bomb, the nuclear age? And I have a comment after that.
Is he? I have a hard time hearing that. Is he famous because of his role in the development of an atomic bomb? Actually, he didn't want to have a role, nor was he invited into it.
It was complicated. I mean, here is Einstein, who basically asks for atomic weaponry to be started, in part because he was so worried about Germany.
Okay.
You know, he had such a deep-seated fear of German aggression that he thought the only way to stop Germany would be to beat them to the punch. But then the story is that once the bombs were dropped on Japan, you know, the quotation that's often attributed to him is that he said, "I could burn my fingers that I wrote that letter to Roosevelt." So on the one hand, you know, in the crush of war, he felt the need to advance nuclear weapons because of the fear of Hitler. But once that threat was gone, he was deeply worried about what would become the Cold War.
And you write in the book that after World War II, he lamented the way the United States had become further militarized during that time, sort of in the way Dwight Eisenhower warned of the military-industrial complex.
Exactly, exactly.
Here's another call. Karen in Baltimore with your question for Steve Gimbel.
Yes, hi. Sigmund Freud, who was another perceived Jewish boogeyman of the Nazis, was also able to escape shortly after the Nazis marched into Vienna. Sadly, he went to England and died shortly afterwards. I was wondering, I think he was like maybe a generation older than Einstein. Did they ever meet? Obviously, they were probably aware of each other, but do you remember, did they ever meet?
They were contemporaries, and they did know each other informally. It's interesting. Freud and Einstein actually have very similar biographies, right? It's in the schools that they both first feel the sting of anti-Semitism. They both reject religion, but ultimately, because of anti-Semitism, come to accept it as part of their identity. Now, Freud and Einstein worked together on the founding of the Hebrew University. You know, both of them were on a board that was going to appoint the original faculty. They corresponded with each other under the auspices of the United Nations, creating a book called Why War? So they exchanged letters back and forth about pacifism, about ways in which humanity could structure itself to avoid world war. So while they didn't spend any significant time with each other, this correspondence between them is really the most significant interaction we have.
Did Einstein support the establishment of the State of Israel?
The answer there is complicated. The answer is yes and no. He was a Zionist of a sort. He did not believe in a Jewish state. He believed in what we now call a one-state solution. He thought there ought to be a safe place for Jews in trouble to flee. He thought there ought to be a Hebrew university which would stand as a beacon to Jews around the world, leading the world in innovation. But he thought that there shouldn't be a Jewish nation. He was opposed to nationalism of all sorts, and he was worried that if the Jews took land, then it would become about land, and it would erode the central ethic that he thought really stood at the heart of Judaism.
So how did he feel about Palestine then? He felt Jews should live in Palestine? He felt Arabs should live in the Promised Land? I mean, where did he come down on that?
The hope was that there would be peaceful coexistence between them, that, you know, he took one trip to Palestine, and Tel Aviv, he thought, was just a marvel. It was a modern city brought out of the desert. He thought that's what Jews could do, is create this wonderful place, but not own it, not possess it, that it wouldn't be their land where others would be removed, but that it would be a peaceful coexistence. Well, life is more complicated, unfortunately.
So the last 10 years of his life after World War II until 1955, he made his views known about militarism. He was a pacifist. He signed a letter with Bertrand Russell toward the end of his life. What's the significance of that letter?
Well, that letter, he sees the world as a whole trending back to what he saw in Europe between the world wars. He had been worried that this sort of nationalistic militarism would become sort of the de facto stance of humanity. And so Bertrand Russell was another, you know, intellectual giant. And the hope was that they could leverage their fame into making people stop and think. They had a deep belief in human rationality. And only if people would stop and realize the foolishness of this approach, that they would embrace a sort of internationalization. Oh, what's it were true?
If Albert Einstein were around today, in 2015, you'd see him on the nighttime talk shows, a talking head, maybe having his own television show to explain science to people. What do you think?
Well, if Albert Einstein were alive today, he'd be very, very old.
Yeah, I know that. Let's say this was his time.
No, he did. He did write a wonderful...
Did he have that kind of personality? I guess that's what I'm wondering. Did he have that kind of personality that you could see him doing, popularizing science? Or
absolutely.
Not?
In fact, he wrote a wonderful book on relativity that was designed for the non-physicist. He really did see the need to communicate to non-scientists about science as a part of this larger project. Right? Science, for him, again, had this picture of internationalization, of cooperative behavior that... Science was the model that would take humanity forward.
You're a philosopher, a historian of science, and you liked physics a lot, too, and you study physics. So this brings it all together for you, doesn't it? You have a scientist, a great world figure, a genius who had so many interests and could speak about and did speak out about so many things.
He was the ultimate Renaissance man and had a great sense of humor. What's not to love?
Stephen Gimbel has been our guest in this hour of the show. I've really enjoyed this, and I welcome you back to Baltimore for doing the show today with us in the studio, Steve. Nice to have you here.
Wonderful to be here.
The students at Gettysburg College of yours are lucky to have you as a professor. Steve is a professor of philosophy and chair of the department there at Gettysburg College. So we've been talking about his two books. The one from 2013 is Einstein's Jewish Science, Physics at the Intersection of Politics and Religion. I hope to finish reading this one. This was published by Johns Hopkins University Press. And the most recent one, Einstein, His Space and Times, by Stephen Gimbel, is part of the Jewish Lives series of the Yale University Press. You can find Freeman Dyson's review of it from the New York Review of Books on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Well, thank you very much, Steve. Well,
this was delightful.
This is great. I really enjoyed it. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in this afternoon. Have a great afternoon, and we'll see you again soon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Alexis Kuhn, Aaron Morenzi, and Mary Troutman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at wypr.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.